God, you are love. Mysterious love that calls us beyond what we are comfortable. Mysterious love that loves us despite who we are. Help us today to learn again what it means to call you a God of love, and inspire us to live into this love, as difficult as it may be. Amen. Abide in my love. This is my commandment. Love one another as I have loved you. I am giving you these commandments so that you love one another. By now, I'm guessing you are sensing the theme of Jesus' teaching this morning, love. As Christians, love is to be the defining characteristic of our lives, because the entire gospel is about the politics of love, the primacy of love. For love is the defining characteristic of Jesus' life, of God's kingdom, of the new creation. And yet this begs us to ask a really difficult question. What is love? It is hard for us to try to define this word today. Is love a feeling? Is love an emotion? Is love a mystical experience? Is it a choice? Is love spontaneous? Is it passive? Is love something that just happens to us? In our society, love has been so charged with sentimentality that we have left the discussion of love to those of the poets, to Hollywood, to psychoanalysts. But how are we to love our enemies? How are we to abide in God's love if we do not know what love is? Making matters more complicated, I'm convinced that the Gospels reveal to us that we as humans are deathly afraid of love. That's what the cross reveals. Jesus is the first and only human to live a life fully out of love. His life was so vulnerable, so unveiled. He never put up defenses or barriers, even when he knew his friends were going to betray him. Jesus kept giving and giving and giving his life away. And in the process, he showed us what we heard today, that God's love is simply friendship. It's the refusal to dominate or control any living thing. Instead, it's the willingness to give yourself away, even at the expense of you. Ultimately, we kill Jesus because deep down, we are petrified of love, of what it demands of us, of how it threatens every aspect of our lives, of how it calls us to deny ourselves and instead learn to live for others. Every act of love is a rupture within our existing world, this world of sin and death. Every act of love calls into question the world that we know so well. And every act of love creates something new, something more expansive than we have ever imagined before. For this reason, what the cross shows us is that we live in a world that cannot afford too much humanity and too much love. And because we both don't know how to describe love, and because we are deathly afraid of love, love today is deeply ambivalent and susceptible to corruption. I'm convinced that what passes for love, both in our popular culture and far too often in the church, is predominantly corrupt forms of love. They are distorted versions of love that strip it of its power, of its destructiveness, of the dangerousness that is inherent to love. I am reminded of Spinoza, who once proclaimed that evil is love gone bad. Evil is love corrupted in such a way that it obstructs the function of love. And so this means uncorrupting love is one of the central tasks for the church today. So what is love? How do we abide in the politics of love that is Jesus? To help us answer these questions, this morning I want to turn to three images derived from the insect world. Actually, all three images come from the insect order Hymenoptera. I meant to pronounce that. Look how I pronounce that. But this is the world of bees and wasps. Our favorite, right? That's where we're going today. So think of love. The first example, I think, is the most prevalent form of love in our society today. So we're going to look briefly at Bernard Mandeville's 18th century story, The Fable of the Bees. The Fable of the Bees, that it helps us understand love today in its most predominant form, shouldn't surprise us, because this fable was deeply influential on many Enlightenment thinkers that formed our society, such as Adam Smith and David Hume. So in this story, Mandeville tells a tale of a beehive that is wealthy and powerful. And in this hive, the bees only look out for themselves and those that are closest to them. It's a hive full of deceit and greed and laziness and corruption. That is, until one day the bees decide to make a choice. They're going to live by honesty and by virtue. The bees, they abandon their desire for personal gain. They abandon the desire to put themselves first, and instead, they focus themselves on helping other bees thrive. But not long after they make this decision, the hive society, it completely falls apart. Through this story, Mandeville proclaims that the only true love is self-love. If we take care of ourselves, if we put ourselves first, then not only will we thrive, but in the end, the entire hive is going to thrive as well. This, I believe, is the most common form of corrupt love in our society. This is an identitarian love, which is merely love of you and those most like you. It's a love that favors those who are most close to you. We see this, do we not, in many forms today. The pressure to love first and most those within our families over against those that are on the outside. The acceptance of those who share the same race or gender or sexuality or religion or belong to the same nation. Identitarian love teaches you that you should love yourself and those most like you first and foremost. And if you don't do that, if you do not love those that are closest to you, then the hive is going to collapse and everything is going to fall into ruin and chaos and disarray. It's not that you don't care about others, but the way to care about others is by caring for you. And this form of love centers on forming and creating the same. It's about supporting the people that are most like you. Much, I think, of what we do at Glennon Heights is combating this form of corrupt love, this evil love that we believe does not promote the most expansive, inclusive nature of God's love for all. So I wonder if a second example might challenge us a little bit more. Another example of corrupt love. So let's turn to honeybees and flowers. I'm assuming we are all familiar with honeybees. Honeybees need to leave the hive to find flowers that are located within flying distance of the hive. Bees fly from one apple blossom to another, one cherry blossom to another, gathering nectar to transport back to the hive. As a bee collects nectar, its legs rub pollen off of the anther of a flower, and then when it proceeds to another flower, some of that pollen on its legs rubs off on the stigma of the next flower. For the flowers, bees are good. Bees help the cross-pollination, which is necessary if they're going to keep producing fruit. And for the bees, the flowers are good. Flowers enable bees to have the food that they need. In other words, bees and flowers have a complicated and beneficial symbiotic relationship. Both parties end up benefiting from each other. This form of love might be best called complementarian or unification. It's about creating a community of mutual aid. It's a form of love that is celebrated because it enables both parties to produce something better, to become something better because of each other. And in many ways, this is the prototypical version of love which Hollywood loves to sell us every day, right? A love that imagines people finding their lost, long-lost match, the missing piece that completes their puzzle so that together they can now make a whole. It's about finding your match made in heaven, the bee to your flower, so that each half completes the other and forms something new, something whole. I'm guessing this is the type of love that we find a little bit more tempting, for it is a love that promotes mutual aid after all. A love that promotes us coming together so that we can produce something better, something that we couldn't do on our own. What I don't want you to hear this morning is that mutual aid is bad. It's not. But the problem with this version of love, the honeybee and the flower, is that it celebrates love for what it produces. It sees love as a means to an end. It celebrates love for the fact that it enables us to create something better. Instead of celebrating love for love's sake, it celebrates love for what love accomplishes. It celebrates love because it enables me to be a better version of myself. They enable me to be a better person. They are my better half. This community's love enables me to do more good. In this example, love becomes another form of production. It's less about celebrating the uniqueness of each other. Instead, it sees love as something that makes us something together. So I want to turn now to a third example. An example that is near and dear to my heart, because Stephanie and I used this example in our wedding. Maybe you all have better images to help you imagine love as something that is radical, something challenging and inspirational. And I'd love to hear whatever images inspire you after church and during the sharing time. But the final example I want to look at today is the example of the wasp and the orchid. As humans, we don't tend to like wasps very much. Bees, sure, they may sting us, but at least they give us honey. They produce something. Wasps don't produce anything. Wasps may inadvertently help pollinate plants, and yes, they eat a ton of bugs. But fundamentally, wasps just want to have fun. Wasps really like to play. And I think we don't know what to do with that. And one of the things wasps really love are orchids. The pheromones, the colors, the shapes, wasps absolutely love orchids. Scientists and philosophers, they are still debating the reasons for this. Do orchids trick the wasps as a way of helping orchids survive? Do wasps even care if they do? There's a lot we don't know about the wasp orchid love. Some say it's a form of trickery, others say no. Orchids are just trying to help wasps do what they do best, and that's to play and have fun. Anyway, it's one of those phenomena that still have lots of riddles that remain unsolved. But what draws me to this picture of wasp orchid love is that it's not some love that tries to reproduce itself. The orchids are definitely not trying to get the wasp to become an orchid. And it's not a picture of love that is centered on production. Wasps and orchids don't complete each other. It's not a merging of two things. They aren't each other's missing puzzle piece. Wasps remain wasps. Orchid remain orchids. Their love for each other, it doesn't obliterate their differences. It lets the other remain the other. It's a love that is not about how much they help me, what they offer or improve. Instead, I see the wasp and the orchid as a calling to embrace the uniqueness, the strangeness, the difficult parts of each other, of anyone that you meet, and find ways to celebrate them and give thanks for the beauty and the difficulties and the struggles that are within them. It's about finding ways to accept and celebrate others for who they are, full stop. It's a love that respects and honors and cherishes the freedom of the individual, especially when they disagree with us or they're nothing like us. Wasps and orchids are probably the most farthest apart things you could ever imagine. We are called to love our enemies, after all. And the only way that we can do this is if we learn to appreciate and cherish the particularities, the strangeness, even the faults that make up each and every one of us. Let your love be like the wasp and the orchid. I stole this line, this image from one of my favorite philosophers, Gilles Deleuze. And ever since reading those words, they have challenged me to be a person that learns to appreciate and honor the difference, the uniqueness, the particularities that make up each and every one of us. The wasp and the orchid, that's a love that refuses to convert the other into being more like us. That's a love that loves not in order to getting something out of it or making something happen. It's a love that refuses to dominate or control another human being. Instead, it's a love that just learns to love for love's sake, that sees love as the end, as the means, as everything. And that's what I see when I look at Jesus's life. Someone who loved and loved and loved and loved and never expected anything or demanded anything in return. And when people didn't love him, he just loved them back. Father, forgive them. Peter, I accept you no matter what you did. If we're going to abide in God's love, then it means loving like Jesus. It means learning how to embody a love for everyone that is completely and utterly free, that doesn't demand anything in return, that is free of domination, free of coercion, free of violence. It's a dangerous, difficult love. Today, as we know, is Mother's Day, which is a day full of so many different emotions. It's particularly difficult this year for those of you who haven't seen their mother, their grandmother, their child, or their new grandchildren since before this pandemic. But parenthood, just like all of life, right, is about learning how to love and give yourself away, to give and give and give without ever expecting anything in return. It's one of the hardest things about life, right? It's about learning how to love in a way that encourages and enables your child to become something other than you. We have to always fight that temptation to make or try to mold our kids into us. It's about learning how to love, not for what they produce, but to love them in a way that enables them to be free to be whoever God is calling them to be. I think mothers know this wasp orchid love perhaps better than anyone. So I'd like to close this morning with a poem composed by Khalil Gibran. The poem is entitled On Children. I think it's a great example of this wasp orchid love, which at least helps me understand Jesus' love for us. This love that we are called to abide in, that we are commanded to share with our world. Here's the poem. And a woman who held a babe against her bosom said, "Speak to us of children." And he said, "Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they do not belong to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you. For life goes not backwards, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children as living arrows are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows might go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness. For even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable." Amen.